Well, good morning. My name is Jimmy Duckworth, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 23rd of 2001. My home group is the Winchester Group in Memphis, and I'm honored and privileged to be here. Thank you to the committee and to Ms. Mary for inviting Melissa and me. Honestly, I think Melissa probably got invited, and I got thrown in as an extra. But nonetheless, it could not have come at a more perfect time. We needed a getaway. I needed to be around some of my kind of people. And the board that puts this on, it has been flawless, and I know that that doesn't happen by accident. I want you to know how much I recognize all the work everyone's done. Tremendous hospitality. You guys have treated us so well, and I'm grateful for that. It's been an amazing weekend. Melissa, you did a wonderful talk, as always. You always touch my heart. Johnny, I haven't heard you talk in a long time. It was fantastic. I heard some things I really needed to hear. And Ms. Wanda, it was my first Al-Anon talk that I've ever heard, and it won't be my last. It was incredible. I took so many things to heart that you said, so thank you. When we were on our way up here, and we got here, and we found out that I was the Sunday speaker. And as all of you know, the Sunday speaker is generally the spiritual speaker, right? So Melissa says, oh, you're not speaking Saturday night, you're speaking Sunday. And I said, the spiritual speaker. She said, yeah, good thing you got all weekend to get spiritual. And I said, you know, a person less spiritual than me would be insulted by that comment. But I am not. I am not insulted by that because I'm so spiritual. So anyway, you're not going to get the general Sunday spiritual talk from me. I want you to know I'm excitable. I typically get riled up, and I have trouble containing myself, as several judges have told me in court. Mr. Duckworth, stop, you know. So I'm told these things, and I know it, and I try not to. But you're going to get what you're going to get. Hopefully what you're going to get today is the truth, my experience, strength, and hope, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. You've got a decent shot of hearing the truth today because my wife's in the front row. But you should know, for years I was a used car salesman, and I'm now a lawyer, so the truth does not necessarily come natural to me. But I'm going to do my best to tell you the truth. So I always like to start talking about my parents. I had a wonderful set of parents. My mother was born and raised on a farm in Manila, Arkansas. They chopped cotton. They worked in the farms before school. They went to school. They came back and worked in the fields. And my mother wanted to get out of there, as most of her siblings did too. She was one of six. She wanted to get out of there pretty quickly. And I also like to say that the grit that I have, the spite that I have, that I've, to good and bad, relied on throughout my life, I know I get from my mother. My uncle told me a story that my grandfather, you know, they'd all be in the fields working, and if you weren't working hard enough, my grandfather would hit them with a belt. And at one point, my mother was a teenager, and he went up, and he didn't hit her hard, but he tapped her. And my uncle said my mother jumped up and said, "Hit me all you want, old man." And he never hit her again. Never hit her again. The amazing thing was I never knew that grandfather like that. He gave us ice cream and money and anything we wanted. And my mother said, y'all don't even know that man. We don't know who that man is. But apparently he was really tough. My mother wanted to get off the farm. She wound up going to Memphis, going to college, and became a flight attendant. Now, my dad was raised in Missouri, also on a farm. Which is odd for me to even think of because my dad is so averse to physical labor in any form. But he was on a farm, and he wanted to go to college, and he did. And he went to Southwest Missouri State, and he played basketball there. Well, one year he had come home in the summer, and he was working on the farm, and he was up on a ladder taking plums out or, I don't know, something. I think it was plums. And the ladder fell, and he fell to the ground, and the plums hit. And his mother said, "Don, don't bruise those plums." And He said he got up and went inside and packed his bag. And she said, where are you going? He said, I'm going back to school. And she said, Don, we don't have the money to send you. He said, I'm going anyway. And he said he had 30 cents in his pocket. He hitchhiked back to school, went and saw the coach and said, I don't have money for tuition, but I want to be in school. And they got him a job and a place to live. And he lettered playing basketball for 4 years. And then he joined the Marine Corps as an officer. So my dad had served in the military, had come home, and he was coaching at a school. He was an assistant coach at a school called Washington University. And my mother's brother, younger brother, Uncle Boyd, was being recruited by Washington University. And he was on a recruiting trip there. And my mother took him on that trip and met my dad. That's how they met the first time. And my dad recruited Uncle Boyd and signed him, and he wound up playing there at Washington. Well, a couple years later, my dad had left Washington and was an assistant coach at Memphis State University, coaching basketball. And he said that he lived in this little apartment, and a lot of times he would pull home and he saw this Volkswagen Bug that had a Washington University bumper sticker, and he always wondered who that was. And he pulled in one day, and that car pulled in, and he got out, and my mother got out, and they recognized each other, and she lived next door to him. They lived next door, and they fell in love and got married, had my older sister. And then my mother told me this whole story before she died, but she said, you know, I had my girl. I only wanted to have one more child, and I wanted a boy. And my dad said they went to great lengths to ensure that their next child would be a boy. So they went to these fertility doctors that told them things like, if you make love on this night of the week, this time of the month, when the moon is in this position, it will conceive your, it will increase your chances of having a boy. And that sounds crazy, but here I am, right? I was the only other child my mother had, and I was born on my mother's birthday. And so my mother and I had a special bond. I grew up in a little neighborhood where my parents played on the in the tennis tournaments at the club. My sister and I were on the swim team. I had a beautiful life. I felt safe in my home, always safe. I grew up with a bunch of great kids. They were all older than me. They were all tougher than me. I was the youngest, so I got beat up a lot, but I always felt safe even then. I knew half the time I deserved it when I got beat up. The other time, I just thought I was paying my dues. So when I was about 8 years old, my mother started going to the hospital quite a bit for an ankle injury, and I didn't think anything about it. We were always nursing sore ankles and things like that. We're a very athletic home. Everybody participated in sports. And one day they sat me down and they said, Jimmy, your mother has leukemia. And, you know, they didn't know a lot about leukemia then. They knew it was incurable. They knew they could treat it to some extent. What they knew that it was fatal. And so they told me at 8 years old, your mother's not going to survive. She's going to die. And my grandmother and my aunt were telling me this, my mother's mother, her sister. And I asked, because I didn't want to accept that, I said, there's got to be something that can be done. That can't be true. And what I heard them say, I don't know that this is exactly what they said, but what I heard them say was, if we pray hard enough, God will spare her life. So, I mean, I prayed. I would even get in my closet and write, God, please save my mommy, on the wall. I can remember the despair of writing that, of just this pleading and this powerlessness of, please don't let my mother die. And it was a Friday. I had seen my mother at the hospital, and she was in pretty bad shape, but she was able to tell me, I said, when are you coming home? And she said, I'll be home in a week. I later found out she probably had no idea what she had even said. But I remember seeing her, and it was a Friday, and city school kids were out of school to go to the fair that day. So I woke up, and I, you know, thinking I'm going to go to the fair, and I run into the living room, and my dad and one of his friends are in there. And I said, Dad, can I go to the fair today? And he said, I don't know, son. Come here, I have something to tell you. Your mother passed away this morning. And I remember I didn't say a word. I just turned and went into my room and got back in my bed. My dad came in there. He tried to talk to me. So then all the relatives are in town for the funeral, and I asked my grandmother and aunt, what happened? I thought you said if we prayed hard enough, God would spare my mother's life. I was at church. The whole church prayed. I prayed. I'm sure you prayed. What happened? And again, I don't know that this is what they said, but what I heard was, God needed your mother more than you. So that was 9 years old when I decided that I had no need for any God. I didn't doubt that God existed. I thought he did, because I can remember standing in the backyard looking up at the sky, cursing him. I did not want to have anything to do with God. He did not keep up his end of the bargain, and I knew my world had just changed. I no longer felt safe in that house. My dad was doing the best he could, but he was ill-equipped. My dad was drinking. He was staying out late. He was leaving my sister and me by ourselves. I was scared. I was scared someone was going to come in the house. I was scared other. And then here's the thing. When other parents started noticing my dad not being home, they would mention it to me. And I thought they were being mean. They were trying to look out for me. And I would defend my dad. And I would say, you don't know what you're talking about. Because I was more scared of losing him than I was somebody doing something about him not being there. So I didn't start drinking at 9 years old, but I started getting in trouble quickly. My grades went from straight A's. I started getting a few B's, C's, and then pretty soon D's and F's. I was getting suspended from school as early as the sixth grade. I'd already picked up smoking. I was just being a real rebellious kid. I was very, very angry. So it was the perfect storm for, by the time I was 12 years old, me and those older kids decided we were going to camp out one night, and we saved up our lunch money all week, and we got an older kid to buy us a fifth of Jack Daniels. Now, at this point, I'd had a few sips of beer, but not enough to have any effect on me, so I didn't really know what to expect from drinking. But I figured it out. I said, the reason I'm not feeling it is because I'm not drinking enough of it, and I'm not drinking it fast enough. So this night in the woods with that bottle of Jack Daniels, I didn't know the difference between Jack Daniels and beer, but I said, when it comes to me, I'm going to drink it hard, and I'm going to drink it fast. So here goes these five boys. We've all told each other's parents we're spending the night at the other's house, and we're going on this camping trip in the woods in our neighborhood. Now, we didn't have a tent or a sleeping bag or a pillow or a blanket, but we did have the essentials. We had cigarettes, matches, a cast iron skillet, a can of pork and beans, a can opener, and a fifth of Jack Daniels, and here we go, right? And so we're in the woods, and we get the fire going, and that bottle comes to me. And I turn it up as hard as I could, and I spend the next 5 minutes hoping no one asks me to say anything because I can't talk. My voice is gone. I feel this fire in my stomach, and the bottle comes to me, and I do it again. And the bottle comes to me again, and I do it again. After two or three pulls, something miraculous happened to me. Believe it or not, I haven't always been bald. I had hair when I was a kid, and my hair was red. And I had freckles, and I was always a little self-conscious about that. But the more I drank, I could feel my hair turning colors. It was not red anymore. I could feel my freckles going away. And these four kids who had all whipped me at various times throughout my life, I was hoping one of them smarted off tonight, because it was going to be payback. I was not taking any mess off any of these boys. But the problem is, I couldn't stop at that wonderful feeling that I had for 7 or 8 minutes, because I had to look cool. So when the bottle came, I did it again, and I did it again. Pretty soon, I can't stand up. When I do try to stand up, I fell in the fire once. We got hungry and decided to cook the pork and beans by holding a skillet over a fire. I ate some of the pork and beans using a stick. And you can imagine what happens to a 12-year-old stomach with Jack Daniels and pork and beans. I'll tell you that they can come out your nose. I was extremely sick. I stumbled home, and I mean stumbled. I can remember I would get up and say, God, just make 3 steps this time before you fall. And I'd take a couple steps, and bam, I hit the ground. And I got home, and I can remember being in my bedroom so sick, holding on to the wall, foot on the ground, please stop spinning. And the next morning, Saturday morning, I was watching cartoons. And my phone rang, and it was one of those kids, and he says, what happened to you last night? I said, I just got cold, so I went home. And they said, wasn't that fun? And I said, yeah. I couldn't wait to do it again. All I could remember was the 7 to 8 minutes when my hair wasn't red and I wasn't scared. That's all I could remember. And that's when I knew alcohol. I had found what I needed in my life. It took away the fear. See, I spent every day afraid of how you looked at me because I didn't have a mother. afraid of what the people in the neighborhood were saying about me. I know now they were probably looking at me with pity, like they wanted to do something to try to help me. I saw judgment. They were judging me. And that's why I was so angry. But when I drank, those feelings went away. I felt okay. So I started drinking as much as a 12 and 13 and 14-year-old can. I drank enough to get into enough trouble to where in the eighth grade I was asked, do not come back to our school system. You should go to trade school. You should find a job. I was 14 years old. And the school system just said, you know, we're not supposed to kick you out until you're 16, but you should look into trade schools. And my father, God bless him, doing the best he can, he just said, well, that's it. You're out of school. So at 14, I was done with school. I started getting odd jobs and working. And I met this some guys, and we formed a band. You know, we were playing in a band. We were going to be big rock stars. And I was constantly getting, about every 2 to 3 months, I would get picked up and taken to juvenile court, you know. All drinking and drugging related, every time. And so I was getting a little bit of a record. And then I met this girl when I was about 16. And she was pretty sharp, other than the fact that she saw something in me. But we hit it off, and she started slowly encouraging me to do something with my life. And this guy that I was in the band with, who's my best friend, Tommy and I were very different when we met. I was 14, had no job, and had been kicked out of school. Tommy was 17, had 3 jobs, was a senior in high school, and was getting ready for college. And we just became best friends. And so Tommy would get me a job, and then he got me a job, and I said, I really need to do something with my life. He said, well, the first thing you need to do is get your GED. So I was 18, and I was working with Tommy, and this girl and I were living together. So he scheduled me to take my GED, and I took my GED and passed it. And I said, what's next? And he said, well, you need to get some college. You know, now you can apply to go to college. So I was going to a community college, and I was making decent grades. And then in 91, Desert Shield started. And that's when George Bush told Saddam Hussein to get out of Kuwait. And I had this this sense of patriotism come over me. And I had this sense of, that's what I can do to make something out of myself. And my father had been a Marine, so I went and joined the Marine Corps. And I remember my dad was taking me to Paris Island, and he was taking me to the airport to go to Paris Island. And I was so excited, and I was telling him, Dad, I'm going to shoot the gun and run the obstacle course like you did. It's going to be great. Of course, my dad was an officer. He did some very different things for me. But I look over, and he's crying. And I said, Dad, why are you crying? I thought you'd be happy. You know, they're going to cut all my hair off, and I'm going to be a Marine. He said, boy, you're in for a rude awakening. And I was. They started us when we got off the airplane. The drill instructors were waiting for us, and they didn't stop until I left Paris Island 13 weeks later. But Paris Island did what it was supposed to do. It made me a Marine, and I was proud. And I went to infantry school. Luckily, my false heroism never got tested, because the war was over by the time I got out of infantry school. And we got to act tough, like, they better be glad it was over, by God. I was on my way. I'd never been more relieved in my life. I remember, if you remember, George Bush told Hussein, you have until January 15th to get out of Kuwait, or we start bombing. Well, I was in boot camp then. So January 16th, we started bombing. You remember, the bombing was all on CNN. So we're standing there at attention one night, getting ready to get in our racks to go to sleep, and the drill instructor rolls the TV in, turns it on CNN, and we all stand there watching it for 5 minutes, and all you see are bombs. And he unplugged the TV, and he said, and every one of you is going. I didn't sleep that night. I was a little nervous. Luckily, the war was over, like I said. So I came home to the reserves. I applied to the University of Memphis. I was accepted. I started making decent grades, and I had my lifelong goal. I was going to be a lawyer, either that or president. I was going to be one of those two things. And one day I was in a class, and these two, what I called the privileged kids, you know, the kids with the that went to private schools, they had the fraternity shirts on. You know, I couldn't stand those kids. And these two came up to me and started a conversation with me. And then they said, hey, we're having a party at our fraternity house tonight. Why don't you come over? And I thought, you know, these boys aren't half bad. I've misjudged them completely. And I showed up at that house that night. And by the way, I had not been drinking at all during this time from the Marine Corps, right? Like, I was able to maintain, and I certainly wasn't doing any drugs. But I wasn't drinking. My life was in order. And so at this point, I think that all the problems I had with alcohol previously were just from being a rebellious kid. Would never have dreamed it had anything to do with alcoholism because I'm not drinking now. And I'm not even having a problem not drinking. So I show up at the fraternity house this night, and I get out of the car, and I look at my clothes, and I can look in the window, and I see them, and I said, I'm not dressed like them. And I feel my hair, my Marine Corps haircut, and I said, my hair is not like theirs. So I was nervous, and I walked in, and just like that night in the woods, I saw the answer quickly. There was a keg of beer in the corner, and something inside me said, drink as much of that as you can, as fast as you can, and this fear will go away. And that's exactly what happened. I drank as much as I could, as fast as I could, and I was no longer afraid. These people were my best friends. I had forged these relationships with this group that had eluded me for so long, these privileged people. They loved me. They didn't judge me. They were happy I was there, and I was one of them. So I pledged that fraternity, and over the course of a semester, I went from a weekend drinker to a nightly drinker to a morning drinker. It happened that quickly. I would drink before class. I would take drinks with me to class. And then shortly, I didn't have any need to go to class. So I flunked out of school. Every semester, I would try to right the ship. I would register for 19 hours. And I'd say, man, I'm gonna get caught up. And I'd go to class for 2 or 3 days, and then I'd drink. And then I'd miss the drop date, so I'd get straight Fs. And the next semester, I would do it again, until they finally said, you can't come back to school here until you make some grades somewhere else. Well, by then, it was too late. I had no intentions of coming back to school, but I had picked up a trade. I had lost a lot of money sports betting in college, and I realized that I was on the wrong side of that equation, that I needed to be a bookie. So a buddy and I started taking bets, and I mean, we were doing well. You know, gamblers typically lose. So we were collecting a lot of money. I was drinking good booze. I was going to whatever concert, wherever I wanted to go. I had a car. I had a place to live. If you would have sat me down and says, you know, you have a problem with alcohol and drugs, then I would have said no, and I would have passed a lie detector test because I had no idea. I just thought I was living a tremendous life. I thought I was living my best life, you know? If the Grateful Dead were playing in Chicago and I wanted to go, I went, you know? And I had the money to do all these things. So, you know, every once in a while, gamblers win. And we had lost a lot of money, and I didn't have the money to pay, so I kind of got ran out of that business. I'd had a DUI by now. I'd wrecked a couple of cars. I was living in a boarding house in Midtown Memphis, and I was waiting tables. And one night, this little girl walked in, 4'10", 98 pounds. She ordered a whiskey sour at the bar, and she would do shots of whiskey while she drank. And I said, I am in love. She is the girl of my dreams. And she and I hooked up, and I moved in with her like within a week. I was getting evicted from the boarding house anyway, but we didn't pay the rent at her place either, so we got kicked out of there. And we were living with her grandmother, who was this little Sicilian woman, and she'd tell us all the time, you're two lost souls. And so, again, I had a burst of, I was able to pick myself up enough to say, I really have to do something with my life. You know, we'd gotten married by this point. I said, I have to make something up for our lives. So I said, it needs to be something respectable. And so I answered an ad to become a used car salesman. It was the very best I could think of. And this was in the 90s. The car business was booming. And I walked onto this car lot, and I started selling cars. And I mean, selling a bunch of cars and making a bunch of money. And it would go well for a while. Then I'd get a big check, and I'd disappear for a while. But the car business is forgiving. As long as you show back up, and they say, you ready to sell cars? Yes, sir. All right, go ahead. You know, they figure they can make more money with you there when you are there than just firing you completely. So there was this guy that sat across from me at this car lot, and he had one of these blue books on his desk, right? And he was always happy. He's always smiling. If he sold a car, great. If he didn't really care. Always had people coming to visit him that he talked to for hours, never sold him anything. I wondered why he was wasting all his time with these people. And his name was Billy. He's always happy, was always polite to me, you know, never imposed anything on me. But, you know, things had gotten really bad. I was standing out on the car lot one day, and there's this guy named Bob, too. Now, Bob, I knew it had some problems with alcohol, and I thought through the church is how he had turned himself around, right? And he had a big house. I mean, he was what I wanted. He was stable, had a big house, you know, was making a lot of money. And for someone who didn't want to have anything to do with God, I knew that was my problem. And the reason I know that now is because I didn't ask Bob, can you help me stop drinking? Can you help me figure out how to stop all these things? What I said to Bob was, Bob and I were standing out on the lot, and I said, Bob, how did you find a relationship with God? And he said, well, I did these. I don't even know what he said, but I remember he said, why are you, you're having some problems drinking, aren't you? Everybody else knew, you know. I didn't think anybody knew, but everybody knew. And I said, yes. And he said, you got to talk to Billy. And I said, wait a minute. I don't want to talk to Billy. I'm not very fond of Billy. I don't need to talk to him. And I've told you, and that's one person too many. As a matter of fact, forget I said anything, Bob. And I walked away, and I went inside the dealership, and I'm looking out this glass window. And about that time, Billy pulls up in a car, and I feel a tap on my shoulder, and it's Bob. And he says, Billy's out there waiting on you. I've already told him everything. And he walks away. I said, God almighty, Bob. So I get in the car with Billy. He drives me to the back lot, and he had a different look on his face. I'd never seen this look to me. It was a look of care. I could tell immediately, this guy that I didn't like, all of a sudden I felt safe with him. He looked at me, and I could tell he cared about me. I could tell when he said, what's going on with you? He really wanted to know. And so he asked me, and I told him everything. And when I started telling him, it was like someone turned on a faucet. All that pent-up angst, fear, anger, it poured out of me. I was bawling uncontrollably, snot slinging, crying. And at one point I realized it, and I was like, oh my God, I am really breaking down in front of this guy. So I, yeah, so man, you know, it's cool. You know? And he says, to this day, we laugh about this, but he said, tell me what you think you should do. And I think he just did that for comedic value. But he said, tell me what you think. And I said, well, I'm glad you asked. I am desperately in need of medical detox, right? Like, I cannot go without what I need or I get very sick. I said, so I have some vacation time coming up. I'm going to take off, go to treatment during my vacation. They'll detox me. I'll come back. Everything will be fine. He goes, yeah, that's not going to work. He said, first of all, you'll be starting your program of recovery by being dishonest. He said, you need to go sit down with the bosses, tell them. He said, and trust me, they already know. You need to tell them that you need to go to treatment, and your job will be waiting on you. That's the least you have to worry about, right? And he told me all these things, and I realized quickly, like, man, that's a, I don't know if I can do all that. So we decided to revisit that idea, right? And I kept coming to work, and then one morning, I couldn't come to work anymore. It was, the wife and I were splitting up. Everything was falling apart. And so I called work, and I called, and I said, hey, I'm going to treatment. And they said, please do. So I went to treatment. It was long term. It was 7 days. And I did what we do in treatment. I made arrangements while I was in there. So they were medically detoxing me. My sister said, you can come live with me. My dad said, when you get out, I'm going to give you some money to help you get back on your feet. The job said, we're going to pick you up every day for work. We're going to take you to your outpatient treatment every morning. Then we're going to pick you up from there and bring you back to work. And you're going to work all day till we take you home. So I had everything worked out. So on that sixth day, when the doctor sat across from me and said, how do you feel? And I said, I feel wonderful. And he said, do you feel well enough to go home? And I said, absolutely. And he said, what are you going to do when you go home? I said, I'm going to call my sponsor. I'm going to go to an AA meeting. I'm going to read my book. I'm going to pray. I told him everything, right? And I went home, and I stayed sober till my sister fell asleep that night. And I stole her car, and I went out, and I got loaded. So I'm going back to work, and work quickly realizes whatever was supposed to happen to you in treatment has not happened. You need to go back. So they send me back. This time I last 4 days. Then they send me back again. This time I last 3 days. And that third trip to treatment, I'm sitting there and that doctor's in front of me, and it was the first doctor to ever tell me the truth about me. He was sitting there and I had a blanket wrapped around me, shivering, sweating, and he said, Jimmy, why do you think you keep coming back here? And I said, I don't know. And he said, maybe because you suffer from a disease that's cunning, baffling, and powerful. He said, what do you want me to do for you this time? And I said, detox me. He said, that's the easy part. What are you going to do after? And I said, I'm going to do, I told him the things, right? And he said, you know, telling me those things and doing those things are too different. He said, so I'm not giving you any medical detox this time. And if you ever come back, I won't give it to you again. So about 3 days was all I could handle that trip, and I left. I wound up sleeping in cars and sleeping on people's couches for a while, but I came into some money at one point and was enough money to get myself back on my feet. I got my own little place. There was a new car dealership that had opened, and they had demos. They were going to give me a car to drive. So I went, you know, I got cleaned up enough to go out there and get hired at this place, and they gave me a car. Which was fortunate because I later wound up living in that car. And so I'm trying to keep it together, and I can't. I just can't keep it together. So one day I called them, and I said, I'm going to Methodist to check myself into the hospital. You can pick up the car in this parking lot. And they said, okay. Well, they didn't come fast enough. By the time I got into Methodist after a day, I had changed my mind, and I went out, and I got that car. And they had reported that car stolen. When they came to get it, it wasn't there. They couldn't get a hold of me. They reported the car stolen. So I'm living in this car, and car living is hard in a two-door hatchback. It's not for a big guy like me. It was pretty rough. There was a night when I had checked into the, as Johnny calls it, the nervous hospital there in Memphis. I begged my way in, and then I threatened my way out, and they finally let me out the next day. And as I got out that night, all I know is it was cold, the sun was setting, and I couldn't bear the idea of one more night on the streets, but I couldn't bear a night in there either. So I was driving around this neighborhood, and there's these two guys in their front yard talking, and I pulled up. I must have looked like death, and I walked up to them, and I said, hey, I'm your neighbor. I'm doing some yard work, and I need to borrow a garden hose. Could I please borrow a garden hose? And the guy says, yeah. He hands me a garden hose. And I drive to a parking lot, and I run one end of that garden hose into the tailpipe and the other end into the car. And as the fumes start coming in, I felt relief. I thought, thank God, this will finally be over. I kind of closed my eyes and prepared to check out. But pretty soon, I didn't smell the fumes anymore. I couldn't figure out what was happening. I'm looking in the hose. So I get out, and I go check the back, you know, where it was running the tailpipe. Well, Hot tailpipe rubber hose. It had melted it closed. And I'm standing there holding this melted hose, and I was like, you loser. I was like, I can't even do this right, you know. As fate would have it, I was two blocks from Billy's house. I drove over to Billy's house, and I knocked on the door. He didn't recognize me at first, and he said, Jimmy? And I said, yeah, and he said, come on in. He found me a place to stay with this old hardcore AA-er named Charlie, and I was sleeping on Charlie's floor waiting to get into Harbor House, and Harbor House said, you got to call every day. So I'd call every day, and they'd say, not today, call back tomorrow. Well, Charlie didn't have a car. Now he had somebody living with him that had a car, and Charlie loved AA, right? We go to 4 or 5 meetings a day. I'd drive this guy. I was like, Jesus Christ, how much AA do you need in a day? And I was still drinking during this time, so I was in meetings, and we talked about this other night. I was going to meetings under the influence, but something was different this time. See, I'd done that before, and I'd gone to meetings, and I heard people, and I thought, that's BS. Everything they said, I said, that's ridiculous. That person wasn't like me. They can't, if they were me, they wouldn't be in that shape. This time, what I would hear them say, I would hear them talk about hope, and I would say, God, I hope I can get to that point. And I would have this hope, maybe when I wake up tomorrow, I won't have to do what I've been doing. Maybe it'll be gone. But it wouldn't be. The day finally came for me to go to Harbor House. I called that car dealership the night before, and I said, hey, I know you've been looking for your car for a few months. They said, no, the police have been looking for that car. And I said, well, I'm going to be at Harbor House in the morning if you want to pick it up. And they said, if you'll promise the car will be there, we'll call the police and tell them we found it, and we'll drop charges. So I said, okay. And they did. And luckily, they came and got it quick. because within a few hours at Harbor House, I was really second guessing my decision. There's no medical detox at Harbor House. I was sick as a dog. And this man, a counselor named Armstead, came. He was a 6'6". He's like Robert, had a big booming voice. And he sat across from me, and he said, and he was smiling. He was this, I call him the gentle giant. He was this huge man. He was smiling. He said, "I'm so glad you're here." He said, "I'm so glad you're here." And this was a Thursday, and he said, "If you'll just make it through Monday, through the weekend, I promise you're going to feel better. You're going to feel better than you feel now if you'll just stay." And I said, "How do I do that?" And he said, "Ask God for the willingness to just stay. You don't have to pray for anything else." And I said, "Armstead, I don't think, if there is a God, I don't think he hears my prayers." And he laughed. He goes, "Just do it anyway. Look at you. What do you got to lose?" And he had a point. So I started praying. I didn't sleep for 4 days. On the fifth night, I was able to sleep a little bit. They had AA speakers come in every morning and every evening. And the difference this time is when I heard these AA speakers talk, I thought, if it happened to him, it could happen to me. It was the first time I had that idea. One of my heroes in AA, Eddie Winter, he came in. He had about 3 years, and his story was very similar to mine. And he read out of the doctor's opinion. And he said, "On the other hand, as strange as it may seem to those who don't understand, once a psychic change has occurred, that very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required is to follow a few simple rules." I can hear Eddie saying that to me now. I can hear him because he preached that to me for so long. And I said, "What are the rules?" I know two things. I was doomed to drink again if I didn't have an entire psychic change. And I would not have an entire psychic change unless I followed a few simple rules. What were those rules? He said, "They're the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous." But before I even started following those rules, I started following rules that I'd never followed before. Rules such as, at Harbor House, you wake up at 6 o'clock and you make your bed and then you do your chores. So I got up, instead of complaining about the food, complaining about the staff, trying to figure out a way out, I got up and I made my bed and I did my chores and I was where I was supposed to be. And I started following those simple rules. Shortly after, I was working the steps while an inpatient at Harbor House. And page 100 of the book says that follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world no matter what your present circumstances. That happened to me on day 9. Day 9, it was 9:45. We were sitting in the common room in Harbor House. The tech walks in and says, 15 minutes till lights out. And I said, that means I'm going to get upstairs and go to bed. This day will be over. And I started counting. And I said, when I wake up tomorrow, I'll have 10 days, double digits. I'd never had 10 days. I lived in that new and wonderful world right then, and my circumstances had not changed. I still had the same pending criminal charges. The wife and I were still split up. My family still wouldn't have anything to do with me, and I had no job. I was penniless and broke, but I lived in a new and wonderful world right then, and that world was hope, because it changed from, if it happened to him, it can happen to me, to, if it happened to him, if I do what he did, it will happen for me. For once, I had faith that work in the program would help me, would do something. So I started working the steps, and I went to the halfway house there at Harbor House, and at 45 days, I did a fifth step to the best of my ability with my sponsor. I told him all the things, even the things I wrote on a separate piece of paper that I did not plan on telling him. I told him because he started by telling me his. He started telling me things about him. And I said, me too, I did this. A funny thing happened as we did my fifth step. I would say, and then I stole this. And he'd say, write it down. And then I'd say, I took this. He'd say, write it down. And I thought, I don't know if I should be writing down all this incriminating stuff. But he had me write it down. Later, he told me, now let's work your eighth step. You wrote most of it when we did your fifth step. So by this point, this is about time I met Johnny. So, after a few months at Harbor House and the halfway house, me and three other guys decided to get our own house, and it was next door to Johnny. We knew Johnny's dad. He was bringing meetings to AA. We were all going to the same group. I mean, our world revolved around that group NAA in South Haven. And we lived next door. And we had a firm rule, the four of us. If you drink, you're gone. No questions asked, right? And I believed in that rule. And one of the guys that lived in there, his name was Greg, and Greg smoked crack. And I came home one Sunday evening, and I'm talking to two of the guys here, and down the hallway, I keep seeing this door open, and Greg's head poke out. And I look down, and his head poke. So, I'm like, I don't know if I saw it. After about three or four times, I said, hey, did y'all know Greg is geeking out down here? They said, yeah, he relapsed this weekend. And I said, boy, I hate to hear that. Where's he going to stay tonight? And another one said, well, we talked about that, and I drank this weekend, so if he leaves, I have to leave. And I said, I hate that for both of you. I really do. I'm sorry. I love you, and I'm sorry, but you can't stay here. And then the third one, the one who didn't relapse, he says, well, we talked about it, and we took a vote, and we decided that they could stay, and that if you didn't like it, you could leave. I said, wait a minute. Who voted? The geeked out guy and the drunk, their votes are over mine. And so I left that night. There was two guys in AA that lived around the corner, had a nicer house, had an actual whole bedroom for me. I called them. They said, yes, please come over. So I moved into better quarters. Shortly after that, I moved in with just one guy from AA. And we bragged because we paid our rent every month on time. I mean, we were never late on our rent. Our lights never got cut off. By then, I was able to get my license back. I was working in the car business. I was making some money. And every time I'd make some money, I didn't go back to work at the same car lot. I worked across the street. So every once in a while, I knew my sponsor was over there. I'd call him, and I'd stand out on the lot and kind of look over there, and we'd talk. My sponsor was big on me making amends. I'd made manager at this store. So I was helping manage this store. And the big boss called me one day and said, hey, this guy named Wayne's going to come by, and I want you to get that white Tahoe, put a dealer plate on it. We're loaning it to them for a golf tournament. So I did that, pulled it up front, had a tag on it. And this guy walks in and says, yeah, I need to see Jimmy. And I turn around, and I remembered the voice. I worked for this guy. This guy owned a liquor store, and I worked for him while I was drinking, which means I stole from him. And I saw him, and I couldn't look him in the eye. And I said, oh, and he was on my list. And I said, hey, Wayne, give me just a minute. And I went out the back door, and I called my sponsor. And I said, Billy, this guy's here. I owe him money. I have the money on me. What do I do? He said, you pay him the money. So I went up to him, and I said, Wayne, I hate to tell you this, but I stole from you when I was working for you. I'm in recovery now. One of the things I have to do is pay back the money I took, so I have to give you this money. I figure it's X amount of dollars. Here it is. And I gave him the money, and he said, you stole from me? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, you were good at it. I never knew. And I said, well, be that as it may, I'm ashamed. I'm sorry. What can I do to make it right? He said, you can keep living the way you're living. And I gave him the money, and the next day, and I'm feeling all good about myself, right? I've made this amends. And the next day, that big boss walks in. And he goes, Jimmy, got a minute? And he just keeps walking. I said, oh, my God, this guy Wayne has told him that I'm a thief, you know? And so we go in the back office, and he says, Wayne says you used to work for him. And I said, yes, sir. And I'm thinking, and now I've just said, well, if I get fired, I get fired. That's, the way it is. So he says, Wayne said you used to work for him. I said, yes, sir. He said, you must have been a good employee. He couldn't say enough good things about you. He said, he really spoke highly of you. And I said, well, I'm glad to hear that. I called my sponsor and told him. He said, it doesn't make any sense, does it? So every time I'd make a little money, he and I would get that list out, and I'd start paying back money. I'd bounce checks all over town. Every one of them was listed on my credit report. I would call one or two at a time and say, I can pay this one. They would say, come pay it, until all those were paid. Now, I'd gone to Boston to work at a car dealership for a little while, and I couldn't take the cold, and I was homesick, and I came home. And so this is about the time I meet Melissa. So I'm going to these meetings, and I'm seeing Melissa, and we're kind of making eyes with each other. And this friend of ours named Kim, who's a dear friend like a sister to me, I ask her about Melissa, and she says, well, she's asked about you too. But she's going through the steps right now. Please leave her alone till she finishes. And I said, well, of course. Of course I will. What do you take me for? I would never interfere with such a thing. And I did. And we were married and pregnant and in love. And I don't know what order those things happened, but they all happened. And we found out she was pregnant, and then later we found out she was pregnant with twins. And I thought, look at what God's doing for me. I'm sponsoring all these people. I'm staying sober. I'm doing service work. God is rewarding me for all this work. That's what I thought. And then we found out it was twin boys. So now I'm thinking, well, three more, and I got a starting five on a basketball team. So I'm so excited. And in early July, Melissa went into labor, and we went to the hospital that night. And I was not worried. I was not worried. I knew whatever was happening. As a matter of fact, I thought if they were going to come early, I was happy because I wanted to see them so bad. I thought, if they're coming, good. I know nothing bad's going to happen. But this doctor pulled me outside and she said, your wife's 4 centimeters dilated. She's 24 weeks pregnant. These twins are going to be born tonight and they're not going to survive. And it didn't faze me. I didn't believe her. And I called Eddie, and Eddie came to the hospital, and I called my sponsor. And Melissa was a trooper. They inverted her. They put her on this medicine that made her sick, so sick, but they stopped her from giving birth for 7 days. And then I was at work on the 7th day, and the phone rang, and it was Melissa. It was the doctor, and they said, you need to come. And I walked in the room, and Melissa's water had broken. I remember she looked at me, and she says, I did my best. And I said, I know you did, honey. And they rushed us into surgery. And because I wasn't out somewhere drunk, I saw my boys born. I heard the only noises they would ever make. Ethan was 1 pound, 13 ounces, and Evan was 1 pound, 10 ounces. When they got him into the NICU unit, they took my wedding ring and they put it over his hand and it dropped to his elbow. They were so small. And we were there at the hospital every day. And it was up and down. Up and down. Some days they were doing better. Some days they weren't doing so good. Evan passed away first after 19 days. They had them separated in the NICU unit. They didn't have them next to each other in their beds. And I always wanted them to be next to each other, but I was too afraid to ask. So I didn't ask. So Ethan had this miraculous turnaround one day, and then it had gone really bad. And this doctor was in there talking to us, and she says, she's trying to tell us what we don't want to hear. And I tell her, I said, if it's all lost, you're going to have to tell me. If there's no chance, you're going to have to tell me. And she said, let's wait through the night. Let's wait through the night and see what happens. So we went home that night. We got a call early that morning. We walked in, and that sweet lady doctor looked at me, and she mouthed. She said, it's time. And one of the decisions that I'll be proudest of, to me, that I made was I had the courage and I went up to the doctor and I said, unhook him from everything and hand him to me, because I didn't get to hold my first son before he died. And Melissa and I held our boy. So now I'm wondering, God, how come you're not keeping up your end of the deal? I prayed for my mother and you took her. I did your work. I'm sponsoring 10 people. I'm speaking at treatment centers. I'm speaking at jails. I'm speaking everywhere. And you take my children from me. I don't remember a lot about the first few months after that time. I remember I worked excessively and I gambled excessively. That's what I remember. I also remember Melissa picked up somebody from a treatment center almost every night and took them to AA. That was the difference between us at that time. Melissa and I were thinking about calling it quits, and we decided, I called her, and I remember saying, we had already decided we were calling it quits, but I remember being at work, and something told me, don't run, and I called her, and I said, I'm willing to try if you are, and she said, I am, and in a short time, she was pregnant, and in July the next year, almost a year after we lost our boys, we were in the same hospital. And this time I had no problem saying anything to any doctor. The doctor was trying to explain to us what was going to happen when she got the spinal block, and he was giving us what's called informed consent. He's telling us all these horrible things that can happen. And I said, I have no problem with anything you've said, but are you going to be the one performing this procedure? And he said, I am. And I said, I have a problem with that. He said, what? I said, your badge says student. He says, I know they make us wear these, but I'm not a student. I said, I've already read the badge. Sorry, you can't do it. And he was very nice, and he went back and he called the head. He said, what about the head of the department and I do it together? I said, now you're talking. So they took Melissa in there, and I got to hold her hand again. And this time they pulled out a 9-pound, 3-ounce giant of a child. 5 years later, right before, by the way, Melissa went back to college when we were married and got her undergraduate degree. And then she went back and got her master's degree. And I had always wanted to be a lawyer, but I had a family now. I was making a living. And I just remember thinking, that's one of those dreams that'll just never come true. You know, I'm not going to ever be able to do that. And then 2008 happened. The economy just tanked, and I said, well, I have no reason to not do this. So I went and applied to the University of Memphis, and they said, well, you'll have to go take a couple of classes at Shelby State first before you can get in. And I did that, and I went back, and I finished up, and I got accepted to law school, and Melissa worked while I went to law school. It was a crazy time. But we had our second son, Sam, a few months before I started law school. So it was a crazy time for us. And I had to do some rebuilding during all this time with God. And I started trying to rebuild it when Melissa was pregnant with Connor because I knew how angry I was. And through some going through the steps again from some outside help, I was able to realize that what kept failing me was not God. What kept failing me was my conception of God. I had a bad definition. I saw God as a gift giver. I saw God as a deal maker. I saw God as, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. I know today that's not what I define God as, right? It rains on the good and the bad, both. So I've had to do some rebuilding on this relationship with God. Melissa and I have really busy lives. So one day we were in the kitchen, we were putting up groceries, and she just looked at me and she said, do you ever think your life will be this good? And I said, absolutely not. We have two beautiful children. Melissa and her family are very tight, especially her and her mother. They're like best friends, so we have this broad family. My dad and I have gotten all the water's under the bridge now. My dad was getting elected to the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame 1 year. And he said, well, I can't make it up there. And I said, you're absolutely going to make it up there, and I'm going to drive you. So he and I had this long drive. We stayed in the hotel for a couple days, and we got everything straight between us that needed to be straight. I'm not grateful enough for the life Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. It's a privilege to be here, but it's a privilege to be anywhere. You know, I was able to, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have this wonderful family. I have this wonderful extended family. And I've been able to do whatever I wanted to do in life. I wanted to be a lawyer. At 40 years old, I became a lawyer. You know, and I can't tell you how much I love being a lawyer. You know, when I walk into court and I hear the bailiff say, good morning, counselor, and I realize they're talking to me, I beam with pride. I love it. And part of what I do is represent alcoholics and drug addicts who have been charged with criminal charges. And the most gratifying part of my work is I stand in court and I tell the judge, you're not going to do him or society any good by locking him up. The only thing that you can ensure is going to happen if you lock him up is he's going to be in front of you again when he gets out. Why not send him to treatment? Let him go to treatment. And if he doesn't comply, then you get to lock him up. Because you'll know, there will be no hiding it. And I've had some success at doing this. I've had some heartbreaks from doing it. But I'll tell you one funny story and I'll stop. I had a guy who had been working with him so hard, they were just going to put him back on probation. They weren't going to arrest him. He was looking at jail time. I had it all worked out. And he showed up to court that day and he was faced. I mean, just... And so I talked to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor said, man, I can't do that deal now. And I said, why not? He said, he's drunk, or he's high, or something. And I said, He goes, go talk to him. I said, look, if anything he says to me, I can't tell you, so there's no need in me talking to him. So we go in front of the judge, and the guy tells the judge, he says, you know, I would do that deal, but I think he's under the influence. And the judge says, Mr. Duckworth. And I says, Your Honor, I can't testify as to his sobriety. It's not for me to say if he is or not. And judge, I'm sure you're aware, even if he told me he was, I'm not going to tell you or anybody. And he says, you're absolutely right. He says, you know, we'll fix this. Let's have him take a drug or an alcohol test. And if he's clean, I'll put him back on probation. If he's not, he's going to jail. And I went up to him and I said, any chance that you can pass a drug test right now? And he looked at me and he goes, depends on what they test for. And I said, well, you don't have any choice. So he goes and takes the test, and I'll be dog, it was clean. So I'm standing with my arm around in front of the judge. I said, Your Honor, let my people go. Now, let me tell you what's happened to him since. His son plays on my son's soccer team, and this guy's gotten sober. And the first time he came to a game, he's just now getting any visitation with his son. He came to a game, and as you can imagine, he stiffed me on my fee for that case. He didn't pay me. But he came up to me, and I said, I'm so glad you look great. You know, and he said, I owe you an amends. I owe you money. And I said, you do not owe me money. He said, you know I have to pay it back. I said, unless I tell you not to. I said, you give that money to the mother of your child and get caught up on child support with it. And I see him, and he seems to be doing well. So we never know when the miracle is going to happen. I want to read something and stop because this is what made me think of all that. On page 153, it says, it may seem incredible that these men had become happy, respected, and useful once more. How can they rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you. Should you wish them above all else and be willing to make use of our experience, we are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. Thank you for proving to me through your recovery that the age of miracles is still with us. If I had not seen it in you, it never would have worked for me. Thank you.
This is not a part of the script, but Jimmy, could you come back up for a minute? I think this is one of the prettiest pens that the military makes for veterans. And how many veterans do we have in the audience? Thank you for your service. On behalf of the United States Marine Corps, the Department of Veteran Affairs, I'd like to present you with this Marine Corps pen. Say thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.